Blog Talk Radio.
United is on the air. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Perfect close to a beautiful weekend. How's the weather been where you are?
The weather was nice. It was really nice Friday. It was nice yesterday. It was a little bit chillier today, but still pretty nice.
That's very good. That's great. Good night, everyone.
I can't believe that we started out talking about the weather. The show can only go up from this point on.
How'd you get here? What road did you take to get here? I mean, while we're talking like a bunch of old people here.
Yeah, really.
Don't you find that that's what older people do? Like they either talk about the weather or they talk about what exit did you take to get here? Yeah.
Oh my God. All right.
They could talk forever about that.
Let's veer off of the geriatric talk as long as we can, because that's going to get here time wise soon enough. But let's stay away from that.
Did you see Limitless?
Yeah. Where can I get those pills?
I know.
Where
that
the hell
something.
Can I get those pills, man? I don't care about the side effects. Where can I get those pills?
All I have are little blue pills around here. So I don't want to. And those make me feel limitless.
Well, that's good.
Now, how was the movie?
It's fun. I was very upset, though, because it's based on a book that I've had in a pile of books that I never, that I have yet to read. I was like, great, I have that. I could have read that. I was like, wonderful. But it's actually a lot of fun. It's a good. I thought it was a fun thriller.
Good.
And he's very good in it, Bradley Cooper. And De Niro's actually not, but doesn't have to be embarrassed about a recent performance. So that's always a good thing.
De Niro's so funny to me. I mean, he had his kind of zombie phase in the 80s for me.
Mm-hmm.
He would pop up occasionally in decent films, and for me, De Niro really came back with This Boy's Life, and then Casino and Heat.
Right.
And which Casino was a real kind of understated performance, but
right.
He anchors that three-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the high point performance-wise in Heat for me.
Right.
And then he's kind of been spotty here and there. You've been curious why he would assume certain roles, but then something that was critically just annihilated, that movie Everybody's Fine,
right?
I thought he was great in. I thought that he showed this kind of sensitivity and humanity in that I hadn't seen before.
Right. Well, you say the 80s, but what about something like Midnight Run or Brazil?
Right. Brazil. I mean, there are exceptions.
Yeah.
I'm talking about stuff like Falling in Love and
Stanley and
Iron. I don't know. Yeah, even though he was decent in that.
Yeah.
But then again, he also did Sergio Leone. Once Upon a Time in
America.
Which
there's another. There's going to be a new cut. They found more footage, and there's going to be a new, there's going to be a Blu-ray release later on and everything.
Good.
So this will be even longer, which isn't a bad thing in that case, because that movie, the first cut that came out wasn't, how should I say it, didn't make a lot of sense. And then they went back and they re-edited it, they put in all the, and it's really quite a masterpiece.
Yeah, and actually that was, Pauline Kael said it was the worst case of a massacre of a film that she'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of Once Upon a Time in America, our first guest tonight is actually, he's a distinguished author and reporter. He's actually written a book called The Film That Changed My Life, 30 Directors on Their Epiphanies in the Dark. And one of the filmmakers he interviews, Michael Polish,
mm-hmm.
the movie that changed his life was Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh, cool.
Irony of ironies.
He's very fascinating. He's the one who, with his brother, the Polish brothers, they made Twin Falls, Idaho, and Norfolk, and
right,
and Jackpot. Very interesting. Great, really underrated trilogy of films there.
Right.
Wow.
Do you know if they're Polish? Do you know if they're actually Polish?
I honestly don't. But have they made anything recently? Have they made? Because that's
forget it. Forget it.
No, I know. I got the joke. I mean, it was sounded.
No,
like
that made me
here
think of this Larry David, the last season of Curb Your Enthusiasm when they adopt the family or two seasons ago.
Oh yeah.
And their names are the Blacks, and he's like, that's like if my last name were Jew.
Oh, God.
It's funny.
No, that's coming back this year, man.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah,
funniest show.
Everyone needs Larry David. It's just something to ground them in.
I was telling you before we started, Big Love, the series finale happens tonight. It has been on fire this season. It's gotten back on track. It's the best drama on TV right now. But it's ending for good after tonight.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. So lock up your wives. Tune in tonight. But Once Upon a Time in America, yeah, Sergio Leone, that was his dream project for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, he wanted
something
to make
else.
The Godfather. I mean, he was one of those directors, thinking about. He definitely wanted to do it.
But you wouldn't have been able to smell the spaghetti sauce like Robert Evans wanted you to do. That's always his argument for picking Coppola. I wanted to smell the spaghetti sauce.
But
get a real Italian director.
I know. But that would have been, with the Ennio Morricone score, a fascinating version.
Yeah.
It would have been completely different. Would not be like the book either. It would be something otherworldly.
Yes, but this is a case of something happening in spite of all odds.
Yeah.
Happening exactly as it should have.
Right.
With Coppola doing Godfather.
You can't think of anyone else. I could never think of anyone else doing it.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Coppola's like, oh, geez, everybody wants to talk about The Godfather. Why am I always tortured with The Godfather? Speaking of which, Kimberly Pierce chose The Godfather as the film that changed her life in this
film. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Sorry, I just hung up on you.
That's okay. I do it all the time to myself. So
if you film that changed your life, I asked you this a couple of weeks ago because we're building our new website. And
yeah. What did I put that?
That'll be up and running next
okay.
week. What did you put? I don't know.
But The Wild Bunch would definitely be one of them. The Wild Bunch or Lawrence of Arabia. When I saw Lawrence of Arabia in the theater, like in 1989 for that restored version, that just changed my perception. That definitely changed me. Because I had watched it on TV, and that kind of film doesn't leave much of an impression when you watch it on TV on a small screen. But seeing it on a big screen, and the same goes for The Wild Bunch, seeing it on the big screen, wow. They, both of those movies just, I mean.
Was that shot in
70
millimeter? Was that shot in 70 millimeter, Wild Bunch?
But it was, a restored version came out in 95, and I went to go see it in the theater. I think I had seen it probably at school in the theater, but just watching it, wow, the big screen was unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars is, of course, that's a huge, huge movie when you go see it the first time. But there are other films, too, I mean, that really shaped me, too. I mean, it's kind of hard to talk about Star Wars because it's often tainted by what comes later. So, I mean,
right,
kind of hard to separate that.
Yeah, and it's talked about so often. The movie that changed my life, bar none, of course, it's obvious, is Burglar. Remember that Whoopi Goldberg, Bobcat Goldthwait?
Yeah, really? You too, huh? I never wanted to own up to that, but okay.
So glad I'm not alone in that.
Burglar.
to answer that seriously, I don't really. I guess it would be Wild at Heart or Born in Sport.
Yeah, that's the film I always, you talk about the most that really changed you. So.
Yeah, it changed me. Anyway, so we got some movie talk to do tonight. We got an interview a little bit later with a filmmaker that just premiered his new film at South by Southwest It's called A Bag of Hammers. He co-wrote it and co-stars in it, with Jason Ritter and Rebecca Hall. So he'll be on a little bit later talking about that. Jake Sandvig is his name. South by Southwest. The Beaver.
The Beaver is, like, I guess, one of the big things to really talk about. That it went over very well.
Yes.
So
the Beaver did not stink.
I didn't think it would. Let's be very honest. Even they showed that trailer in front of Black Swan, and while the audience was kind of stunned, unless I'm really mistaken, I think he's going to be, that's the welcome back film. I really think that Mel Gibson is really going to come back with this film, and people are going to, it will take him, well, at least respect him as an actor, because he hasn't really hasn't acted a hell of a lot in the last decade. So, I mean,
right.
And I think this is the movie to come back with that so mirrors, you know, everything that's going on in some ways. I think this is it. I think this is one of the, you have a May, two serious movies coming out in May, The Beaver and Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it there with that again.
Both of which are kind of antithetical, summer movie fair.
Oh, big time.
Thing that works in their favor.
I think so. I think people, because May is already, you got Thor, Pirates of the Caribbean. You also have the week before all this, actually, the Fast and Furious movie. So you're going to have so many big budgeted special effects extravaganzas. I think people will definitely. And I think people will be so curious about the Beaver. I don't think it's. Well, of course. I mean, unless. But people want to see. What did they? Did people go see Edge of Darkness? I don't remember. Was that? Did that do well? Or was
it was
that?
It was a moderate hit.
Okay.
I mean, moderate success. Yeah.
So I think people might gravitate towards this. I could be wrong, but.
I don't know. It's very, very offbeat.
Yeah.
And it's a brave movie with or without Mel Gibson. But I'm sure Mel Gibson gives it a lot of pathos and.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been one of the great screen actors. I mean, and what works for him is what obviously doesn't work for him in his personal life. There's this there's this volatility and this just underneath the surface kind of boiling rage, you know, but this deep emotion that always worked for him in his movie roles.
Right.
So The Beaver would be interesting, and Tree of Life. I guess it's just an odd summer release. It's just an odd month to release Tree of Life. It seems like Academy fodder. It seems like it would be a holiday release.
Yeah, it's something that I really don't get. I would wait till the fall to release it, but
yeah.
Maybe they will. Maybe when is it going to screen? Is it going to screen at Cannes? Is that the deal?
Well, that's it. That's what they're thinking. They haven't announced it yet, but that's what they're hoping. They're saying that, they cleared a spot for him last year, thinking that they'd get it,
right?
And they didn't. So the Cannes programmer basically said, Malik, you owe us, or they reserved a bunch of suites or something for him because they're expecting him to come there with the film. I don't know.
Okay, well.
So that's what they're thinking. So if it does, I mean, it'll be right on, the release will be right on the heels of the premiere at Cannes, because that's in May, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
Early May.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's get to our first guest tonight. And our first guest is Robert. His new book is called The Film That Changed My Life. 30 directors on their epiphanies in the dark. It's a great, great book. It features 30 of the top filmmakers going in depth about the movies that shaped them and why, and just a great assortment of movies. Plus the two most popular movies among filmmakers that he approached for this book. You'll be very surprised to learn.
Okay.
It's revealed in this interview. The book is available now. You can actually purchase it here on our website. Click that Amazon link, and it'll take you directly to the page where you can snatch it up for yourself. Here is Robert talking all about his love of movies and his new book. Tell me about you. When did your kind of film geekdom start?
My film geekdom started about actually 1992. I mentioned this in my book, but the film that changed my life is literally Reservoir Dogs, and it was the first time I was able to sort of, you know, see a director's, you know, fingerprints, their sort of force of personality, their DNA inside the film. So, you know, lots of films do that. Orson Welles certainly did that. But for me, it was Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs.
And it was this, in particular, the scene, the Tim Roth, the story within a story kind of montage.
Yeah. Yeah, I had never seen that, you know. And again, we're giving away the end of the film. but it is that Tim Roth learning to be a cop, the story within a story, and then he's inside the story telling the story. I have not seen that ever done anywhere else. And it just made me sort of recognize this force of personality putting this together.
Yeah, and had you ever been particularly moved or inspired by films prior to that, or was that kind of the ultimate aha moment for you?
It was the ultimate aha movie, but you know, I was in high school. I had already loved you know, Monty Python, especially the Holy Grail, but you know, nothing that had really sort of altered my perception of how to tell stories. You know, it's happened since, you know, where I see a film, you know, and mostly when we see films that we admire or astonish us, they don't actually change our lives. They change the way we think about something or feel about something. But occasionally, you know, this happened to me a couple of years ago when I saw Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. To me, the central message of that movie is, you know, we may be incompatible. Like, as a couple, we are incompatible, and it just might not work, no matter how much we love one another. But it is still worth finding that out. It is still worth all of the pain of finding that out. And that was revelatory to me, you know, really sort of interesting character insight, and sort of changed the way I sort of felt about, you know, love and relationships.
But since Tarantino kind of provided you with this aha moment, and you wrote a book about 30 film directors on the films that changed their lives, did you reach out to Tarantino at all?
Yes, it was not for lack of trying. you know, so Quentin, if you're listening to this, filmchangemylife.com, drop me an email. Yeah, I will probably do a sequel, and I will, you know, I will wait outside his house if I need to get him in the book. But yeah, I mean, in large part, he was a great inspiration for the book, and even though his voice isn't in it, you know, it's his fault.
He started the ball rolling. So
when
you came up with this idea to write this book, what did you think you would uncover? What did you think would be expressed by this exploration?
Well, I'm actually, this book is sort of a larger extension of my journalistic career because I am fascinated by epiphany moments. And so my last book before this was called Last Words of the Executed. It's an oral history, basically, of the death penalty in America. And it's about exactly what the title is, you know, what people choose to say before they are put to death. And, you know, an epiphany moment of sorts, you know, it wasn't even a political book. It just simply asked, you know, if these are the most, you know, dangerous, reviled members of society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say? So I was always fascinated with that. I also run a pair of websites called It Was Over When, Tales of Romantic Dead Ends, and It Was Love When, which is, you know, it's much sweeter sister. But, you know, that moment you realize that your relationship is doomed, and it's not even a breakup story, but that internal moment where you're like, yeah, this is not going to work. I am fascinated by it. So this book is a natural extension. And unlike those other projects, the directors I talk to, their epiphany moments actually lead to something. They lead to, you know, a product. They lead to, you know, an entire artistic career. I remember talking to Steve James, the director of Hoop Dreams and this new film coming out, The Interrupters. He thought, you know, as he was going through film school, that he would be a dramatic director. You know, he would direct dramatic films. And then he saw Barbara Kopple's Harlan County, USA, which is a documentary about miners.
Mm-hmm.
And it completely changed his direction. You know, he's like, okay, I want to become a documentarian. You know, Kevin Smith basically said, you know, I always love film. I went to go see Slacker, and it, you know, it's the film that made him go to and then drop out of film school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but really, really formative experiences. They literally sat down in the theater, and then 90 minutes later, they were a new person.
Well, this is part of what fascinates me, and we talk about it a lot on the show, is when you take your favorite film and you kind of examine it and defend it, an interesting point is what that choice of film says about you. With Reservoir Dogs, what do you think the appeal of that film for you says about you?
Well, I actually want to disagree a little bit with your premise, because sometimes it's not a choice, you know, what you choose your favorite film to be. For example, for John Landis, for him, it was The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And that's not because that's the greatest movie ever made or even a great movie. You know, it's got some great Ray Harryhausen monsters in it. But it changed him because he sort of saw the craftsmanship behind the picture.
Right.
You know, he wanted to know who the director was and how they did that. So, you know, I think sometimes the films choose the people rather than the other way around. You know, you're just hit with something and then you have no choice. You know, it sort of takes hold of you. Who talks about Apocalypse Now in the book. You know, just says, you know, if I had to choose one film to nail to my heart, this would be the one. And I would argue, like, that film was already nailed to your heart. You know, that was the one that made you the director you were. It made you want to pursue this career path.
Right. And Apocalypse Now was Danny Boyle's choice for the movie that changed his life. And you can see that reflected in his art. That kind of overwhelming, visceral, sensory kind of experience that he creates in his films.
Yeah, and he tried, you know, something similar in The Beach, except it didn't quite work. You know, he's actually very funny about, like, you know, trying to create his own Kurtz movement. And actually, it was also very telling because he talked about how, you know, you're the director and, you know, you're in charge of things, but at a certain point, a film takes on a certain personality, and it tells you what it's going to be.
Another thing that interests me in the book, John Woo, and you had previously edited a book of interviews with John Woo. Did you kind of make a connection with him at that point and just called upon it again for this book?
Yeah, exactly. I knew John pretty well because the book you're talking about is John Woo Interviews, which I tried to craft into sort of the most authoritative, you know, English language book about his life, and he actually didn't want me to do the book to begin with because he had had some other biographies that were just inaccurate and he felt, you know, misquoted and whatnot. So I promised him that, you know, we would fact check the hell out of it and it would be true to his voice, and it would be fair to him. And I think he really, really appreciated that, and I think that's why he agreed to be interviewed for this book.
Yeah, and his choices are his choice is surprising. I mean, he was deeply influenced by James Dean and Rebel Without a Cause.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's because he never felt like he connected with his own parents. You know, he was very much you know, of the artistic background. You know, his parents and even himself. He is a deeply religious man. He's Lutheran. He wanted to be a Lutheran missionary. But eventually he found that he didn't have the temperament for it, which is exactly what, you know, Scorsese's life was like. So they're sort of in line lockstep with that as well. But, he just had a hard time connecting with his parents. And that's what Rebel Without a Cause is about. It's just that generation gap.
Yeah. And also Mean Streets meant a lot to him too. He chose two films.
Yeah, and he was one of two directors that sort of were steadfast in saying, no, it's not just one film, it's two films. And with Mean Streets, the thing that I, again, was just amazed at is something I'd never picked up in his work before, which is he is obsessed, as many fans of his will know, with religious imagery, you know, doves, and many of his action sequences take place in churches and whatnot. But what I didn't realize is that's all Catholic imagery. He's
right.
in love with Catholics, not Lutheran imagery. And I sort of pointed this out to him, and he was like, yeah, that's all because, you know, Harvey Keitel in Mean Street goes to a church and asks for forgiveness, and I've always just loved that, and I've loved the hymns. And I said, John, are you telling me that Martin Scorsese almost made you a Catholic? You know, which he sort of laughed off, but it's true. You know, it's one of these really interesting disconnects. You know, he's in love with, you know, Catholic imagery, but, you know, at heart, he's Lutheran.
Yeah. And he speaks about meeting Scorsese as well, and how generous Scorsese was to him, I believe, too, in the
yeah.
book.
Yeah, and that's one of the other great things of the book is I'm able to talk to people about meeting their idols. You know, like
mm-hmm.
Billy Pierce gets to meet Francis Ford Coppola, and she picks The Godfather. And then sometimes people were afraid to meet their idols, like Henry Jaglom, for example, who talks about Fellini's 8 1/2, was on a plane with Fellini. You know, Fellini was
yeah.
in first class with his wife, and Henry never went up to say hello because he was so nervous. And mm. I think he regretted that for the rest of his life.
Did you have any of those kinds of experiences meeting some of these subjects for your book? I mean, did you have a tinge of nervousness meeting some of these people that you've admired from afar?
Mostly not, because I think that's just a professional thing. I think, you know, people, mostly directors, go around being nervous with them all the time, you know, or people just complimenting them all the time. So directors and Hollywood stars in general want nothing more than to have a normal conversation. So I think I've shook most of that from my personality, so that when I approach them, it's just as like a fellow film fan, mm-hmm. and somebody who just admires movies. And I show them that with my research, because I research the hell out of a movie before I get to, you know, to talk to them, because I want to show them, like, you were gracious enough to give me this half an hour, hour, or, you know, in Kevin Smith's case, 3 hours to talk about this film.
Yeah.
I want to be prepared. So, you know, only occasionally does that happen to me. And I do have one regret, because, you know, I connected actually with Robert Altman, and he agreed to be in the book. And then we could never get it scheduled, and he passed away before we could chat. So that's the one regret I have in the book, yeah.
Did you find out from him prior to that what his favorite film or the film that changed his life would have been?
No, except for he loved the concept and he would be more than happy, and he left me a very nice phone message, and then it was all just, you know, me trying to schedule things through assistance after that, and again, in very quick succession, he had passed away.
Mm, that's terrible. That's terrible.
Yeah.
And he's one of the all-time great, just original artists. So that would be fascinating to have had a discussion with him about what movie changed the course of his perception on film. That would have been great.
Sure. Well, especially since he had such a deep background in TV. You know, he
yeah.
was doing episodes of Combat, and, you know, like, so the TV way of marshaling a crew and a very small crew together, that would have been fascinating. Like, okay, so what was the line between movies and TV for you, and what did you learn from your TV days, and how did you bring that to movies, and then what model did you follow once you were in movies? That
yeah. yeah, yeah. You mentioned 8 1/2. And my understanding is there's a connection here, because a lot of favorite films for a lot of these subjects turn out to be 8 1/2 and Raising Arizona. Those two titles came up more than any other.
Yeah, people sort of fought over them. And I tried to say, like, listen, we can't have two or three chapters about Raising Arizona, because Edgar Wright, who talks about American Werewolf in London in the book, actually said, oh, you know, I want to talk about Raising Arizona. And then he actually said, you know what, I've sort of talked about it too much. And J. Duplass talked about it in the book. Who else wanted to talk about it? there's one other person, Joe Swanberg, who did Hannah Takes the Stairs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all sort of fought over that film. And it's a generational thing. It really is, because for 8 and a half, Kimberly Pierce also said 8 and a half. I'd already interviewed Henry Jaglom about it. Terry Gilliam, who said yes to the book, wanted to talk about 8 and a half and wouldn't talk about anything but 8 and a half. So I lost Gilliam for the project, unfortunately.
Mm.
It's really, really interesting to see what those films like have in common. And that's just, you know, a unique, uncompromising vision. But I could not think of two films that are more unalike than those two films.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been trying to come up with a connection, too. And you're right. It's kind of a generational thing. And along that line, if you were to write this book, say, 20 years from now, another one of these books. I know that it's going to be a series, and I want to ask you about that. But
sure.
When you look at the films of today, as opposed to the films that we grew up with and the people that came before us grew up with, are you optimistic?
Yeah. I mean, everything will find its – every generation will have its big sort of artistic push. I mean, I am 35, so the films – that had the most impact on me are basically every book in Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes. You know, like that
mm-hmm.
whole Sundance era, you know, Clerks, Pulp Fiction, Go Fish, you know, Do the Right Thing. That captured, you know, it was the right place and the right time. I think, you know, for another generation of filmmakers, you know, maybe some people are caught by, you know, what's been called mumblecore, which is, again, you know, Mark and Jay Duplass, Joe Swanberg, that whole group of people. But then there's also some just really amazing stuff. I think we talked about, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I think that's truly a film that if, when people encounter it, they're just like, how is that done? And in fact, I know that on a rival podcast, Film Spotting, they've actually retired it. They're sort of not allowed to talk about it anymore because they just, you know, that like Citizen Kane, Eternal Sunshine, and a few others, you know, they've just retired as classics. So I think that movie in particular is one of those movies. I think maybe
yeah.
Dark Knight. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think? What do you think of the movies that are going to stand the test of time here?
Well, I think all of those are terrific, and I definitely think they will stand the test of time. I'm thinking of the big movies when we were kids, because I'm around the same age as you. I'm 37. I mean, E.T., which is covered here in the book, also. And now today we have things like Transformers, and the big budget films are. They're not really about anything for the most part. And I'm thinking, and I look at something like Scott Pilgrim that does not necessarily succeed at the box office, and that is a movie that I would be thrilled if kids were inspired by, because that movie has real imagination and inventiveness behind it.
Yeah, and I can watch it over and over, by the way. I just watched it again recently.
Absolutely. I mean, it is so alive, that film, and so creative. And I would love for kids growing up to be inspired by that. But very few movies are really, in the big budget realm, really about anything. Maybe I'm just being too pessimistic and fatalistic about it.
But it's also the golden age of TV. I mean, it really is.
Right.
I think, you know, maybe it's the platinum age of TV. You know, you have amazing things like, you know, The Walking Dead and Mad Men and,
yes.
You know, 30 Rock. So, I don't know. I think inspiration is where you look for it. But I also think, like, there's some amazing documentaries coming out. You know, things
mm-hmm.
like The King of Kong and, you know, Exit Through the Gift Shop, which may or may not be a documentary. You know, those kinds of things, I think, are just extraordinary. And I think there is, like I said, there are things that can turn you on to cinema. It's just people find them differently. And you know,
yeah.
I watch Reservoir Dogs, not in the theater, but on videotape. And I think, you know, a lot of my directors in the book who are older would just be appalled because, you know, to them, film is supposed to be seen on a big screen. But again, I had this life-altering moment on a screen that I'm sure was not even 30 inches wide.
And that reminds me of something John Landis says in your book about 2001, and about it's a film that demands to be seen on the big screen to appreciate its full impact.
It has no impact. You know, that's not to say
right.
It has no impact if you see it on a smaller screen, but he's right. He also ends with something that I think is really, really important, which is the film that changes your life has everything to do about you and how old you were when you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it may not be the greatest film in the world, but it spoke to you and it touched some part of you. So, this film did not change my life, but I think that men are allowed to cry at two things, the Olympics and Toy Story 2. I think we just get a pass. So.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I cry at pretty much everything. I'm just that kind of confident guy. So.
What was the last thing that made you cry? I'm curious.
Oh gosh. Commercials make me cry. Actually, there's a film called came out a few years ago that nobody knows about. It's a movie called The Assassination of Richard Nixon. Sean Penn, and I watch that movie and I just bawl at Sean Penn in that film. It's such an incredibly kind of moving performance to me.
Mm-hmm. I think Benjamin Button actually did it, and that's not to say again the greatest film in the world.
Me too.
I had just had twins, and so I was at the end there I was easy pickings. Before that, curiously, it was the Disney film Cool Runnings, but that was just because I had a fever and I was at home and I had nothing else to do. Seriously, I was so sick. But I was like tearing up when they were like bringing the Jamaican bobsled across the finish line. I was really, really sick.
Yeah, well, I would imagine so. But sometimes I'll find myself crying in movies, and I'll say to myself out loud, am I really crying in this? What am I doing? But a lot of times I'm just moved by creative people that are absolutely at the top of their game. I mean, I find that so inspiring and emotional.
I was trying to think of, but there's nothing in the box office recently that made you do that?
The Fighter,
which
yeah.
I've not caught up with yet, so I'm looking forward to that.
And actually, something like Black Swan, which is another of my favorite movies of the year, I just the pure, like, delirious, just nonstop creative pace of that movie, it exhilarates me. I mean, I get so excited talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two favorites of the year, The Fighter and Black Swan, so...
I think I may have mentioned I have 2-year-old twins. Much harder for me to get to the box office nowadays.
Yeah, I understand that. So this is going to be an ongoing series?
I'm hoping it will be, yeah. I did just sell the sequel, and it's a little bit different tack, but the title right now is The Best Film You've Never Seen, and again, it's a working title. Mm. But I'm talking to directors about a movie that they love that has either been critically savaged or it's been lost, or, you know, basically they're defending it as a classic, or they're defending it as something that needs to be reconsidered in film history. And that's been a lot of fun. I interviewed like the Brothers Quay recently, I got a note from Guillermo del Toro who wants to be in it. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
That's a great topic, because there's so many kind of hidden treasures out there, and that would be very eye-opening for movie fans. So you're in the process of putting that together now?
Yeah. I'll have, is it 6 months left? Maybe it's a year. But you're talking to somebody who is actually releasing 3 books this year by accident, so I have to get the other ones out and straighten my head first.
What are the other ones?
They're the websites that I mentioned
okay.
at the beginning of the interview. So it was Overwhen is out in April, and it was Love When is out in December.
Wow. Well, tell me what on the topic of hidden treasures. If you were to recommend some hidden treasures to our audience, what would they be?
I mean, I don't know how hidden they are anymore because of cable. But I have a deep affection for Peter Jackson's Brain Dead, or it's called Dead Alive in the States.
Yes.
Film is so disgusting and so funny at the same time. I remember talking with Bill Condon about it. Bill Condon did Dreamgirls and Kinsey, and he's directing the new Twilight films. But he said, so Ian McKellen, got the job as Gandalf, and he wanted to watch some of Peter Jackson's work. And he said, I think we made it about 10 minutes into Brain Dead. So Dead Alive, I love. I love almost anything with Kurt Russell in it. There's a film done. God, who directed Terminator 3? What is his name?
Man. I'm usually so
anyway,
good at this.
Yeah. Anyway, there's a film done by that amazing director called Breakdown, and it's a small film. It's amazing. I love Breakdown. And as long as we're talking about Kurt Russell, if you have not seen Used Cars, you're living on half a lung.
Jonathan Mostow, the U571 guy, did Terminator 3 and Breakdown.
Jonathan Mostow, amazing, amazing film. Breakdown is just a tight little thriller that I like. Whenever it's on, whenever I can catch it, I always watch it. It's a truly sort of overlooked masterpiece. It's sort of like Red Rock West. For anybody who has stumbled upon Don Dahl's Red Rock West, sort of the same temperament, except for it turns up the heat a lot more.
And John Dahl's choice in your book is A Clockwork Orange, we're in the middle of a year-long Stanley Kubrick series on the show. So I read that chapter on Clockwork Orange with great interest.
John is really interesting because he saw A Clockwork Orange in a drive-in movie theater. Like, how weird is that? You know, and we actually found out that we're from the same town. We're from the Billings, Montana, which is the largest city in Montana. And he talked about seeing this movie in a place that I knew about, that I went to as a kid. So very, very interesting that a drive-in movie can change your life.
Yeah. And finally, I want to ask you another movie geek question, because I was hearing an interview you did not too long ago where you said that a lot of times you'll watch or you'll listen to the commentary on a DVD because you prefer it over the actual film.
Sometimes. I think I said that about Carousel recently because I have a crush on Shirley Jones of that era. And Carousel is not a film that has aged well.
Right.
And, sometimes the commentary, when it has the actual people, it's just a more engaging film because it makes you appreciate it. The same thing can kind of be true of this book, because it's maybe a film that you didn't connect with, or, maybe you don't like it for one reason or the other, but hearing somebody else talk about it really makes you appreciate it, which is, again, why I am addicted to commentary tracks.
Right.
A good commentary track, especially if you get somebody who's gabby, like Kevin Smith. Again, many of Kevin Smith's films you can watch over and over, but you can listen to the commentary tracks over and over and over. It's people around the table having a good time. I'm actually sad that there are fewer commentary tracks today.
That is what I was going to ask you. Who some of your favorite directors are for commentary, some of the most dependable for entertaining commentary.
So Kevin is number one, Kevin Smith.
Mm-hmm.
I love Steven Soderbergh.
Yes.
Doing commentary, especially when he does it for like Schizopolis, that is a great commentary track. I love Hong Kong films as well, and there are some of those Dragon Dynasty films that have really great, esoteric commentary tracks. David Shute, who's a wonderful writer and a contributor to Film Comment, I think he may even be one of their editors. He does really, really great commentary tracks. So, I have been known to find a commentator I like and follow his stuff. I cannot remember the name, but there are a few people who are like that for Criterion discs. You know, Peter Cowie is sort of dry and academic for some people, but I could listen to a Peter Cowie commentary track for forever.
Okay, that is Robert Elder. The book is The Film That Changed My Life, 30 Directors on Their Epiphanies in the Dark. It's available now in bookstores and from our website here. All right.
That was great.
Yeah, and some nice picks there and some nice conversation about a number of topics.
Yeah, I know. Those are really good.
So, Raising Arizona at 8.5.
Wow. No. Yeah. I mean, that's, wow. I was thinking that, like, what happens if all these people start saying the same movie? I mean...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you know that Justin Bieber has passed Michael Jackson for the U.S. box office victor? His movie, Never Say Never, has officially become the highest-grossing concert-themed film in history, passing Michael Jackson's This Is It.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
$72.2 million.
Okay.
Do you think we'll see Bieber, Never Say Never, in one of the future volumes of the films that changed my life?
No, but I'm hoping that we see, like you said, Scott Pilgrim or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I'm hoping we see those, but no, I don't think we'll see Joe. I don't even know. I'd be very curious to see what happens to this kid as he gets older. That's really...
Right.
I don't, you know, the way things work sometimes, will anyone even know who this kid was in like 2 or 3 years, you know?
Who knows? I mean, and it won't be his fault necessarily.
No.
I mean, he's, like a lot of pop stars nowadays, he's created.
Yeah, he did. He's done, obviously, he's doing something right. So, I mean, to be that popular, I mean, that young and that popular, my God.
A team of chemists and scientists have concocted Justin Bieber in a laboratory and promoted him onto the world.
Wow, it's like all sorts. That's creepy. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So, what else came out this weekend? The Lincoln Lawyer. Did you get a chance to see the Lincoln Lawyer?
Yeah, that I saw. But I wanted, before we talk about that, I want to talk. There's another movie I saw that I really, really liked. And if you would have told me a couple of years ago that I'd like this movie, if you told me like 10 years ago that I'd like this movie, I'd laugh at you. I'd laugh at you and then go slit my wrist. I saw the new version of Jane Eyre.
Uh-huh.
It's fucking awesome.
Okay.
It's really well done. Obviously don't know much about the story. I know obviously about the Brontes. I know of the book, but I've never read it. I've never watched the other versions, especially the Orson Welles version, which a lot of people hold as the best version. But, it's just great. It's just really, and I guess it helps because I really knew nothing about it, and I'm watching this thing unfold, and I was really just captivated by the whole thing. And I was just like, this is really cool. This is really well done. It's directed by the same person who did Sin Nombre.
Right.
And it's just a really well done film.
Well, good.
I mean, everyone's good. All the performances are good. Obviously, Michael Fassbender is just incredible, but it's just really a well-done film. I mean, you would have told me the same thing that I like the Pride and Prejudice that came out a couple of years ago. That was really great. And it's just recently, like, these period pieces that are based on classics, I think just some of them lately have been, I think, really well done, and this is no exception. This one, it's just really good.
Well, okay.
Yeah,
I'll have to check it out then.
Yeah, I loved it. I was not bored. And like I say, if you told me like a decade ago I'd like a film like this, I would have laughed at you.
Well, good. Is it more gothic in tone?
Well, here's the thing. There is a gothic element to it that I don't know much about it because I was like trying to figure why would people call this gothic? And as you're watching it, you realize why. And, I'm sure anybody familiar with the story knows what I'm talking about. But it's like the thing that goes on, you're like, you know, I didn't know what some of the major plot points were. So when they are unveiled, it's like, wow.
Mm.
Very well done.
Good. So The Lincoln Lawyer.
Deborah in the chat room said she thought it was Matthew McConaughey's one of his best performances. I like a couple of his movies. Not obviously the romantic comedies, which really get insipid after a while, but this is definitely up there. I never read this book. I've read a lot of books by Michael Connelly, but I haven't read the recent ones, and I haven't read this one yet, but he knows how to tell a good story. And I actually thought this is a very engrossing film. A lot of major like plot twist and a good story and a great performances all around.
Mm.
And I enjoyed it.
Good. I need to see that one too.
Yeah.
Just haven't been out.
Yeah. No. So those are good. Those were very good. Now you saw a movie though. I saw you put the Clint Eastwood movie.
Right, Hereafter.
And you liked it.
I did like it.
Mm-hmm.
I did like it. And I'm always shocked when I like Eastwood movies.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm always...
All the way through.
Yeah.
I thought it was very good. I thought it was way outside of his usual comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the tsunami scene was kind of astounding at
the
very beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, what a way to open the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interested in all the multi-character arcs.
Yeah.
I thought Matt Damon was very, very good. And I thought it was moving, but
mm-hmm.
I didn't think... And I thought his kind of leisurely paced, nothing's done in exclamation points
right.
Approach was different from the way a lot of paranormal-themed movies are done. You know, and
right.
I appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Did you like the way he tied up everything at the end? I thought that was rather a good way to do it.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
you expect,
I thought that was neat.
Yeah,
I thought that was good.
Yeah, it was fine. It was good. It was good. I liked it.
Good, good. That's what we want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next movie is about J. Edgar Hoover.
right. Leo. I don't even know who else is cast in that.
Well, oh God, I don't know either. Leo's the only one I know of offhand.
You know that for all of you aspiring actors out there that feel that you embody the spirit of Tupac Shakur, there's an online audition process happening right now to play Tupac in a feature film.
Oh, wow.
It runs till April 30th. It asks individuals who think they embody Shakur's spirit to submit a 5-minute video in which they perform a provided courtroom monologue and their favorite Tupac song. They're looking for someone with the right mix of raw charm and charisma for the role.
Wow.
So an unknown. It's being directed by Antoine Fuqua.
Okay. His last movie was Brooklyn's Finest, right?
Yes.
Oh, wow. This should be interesting.
Shooting is scheduled to begin over the summer. So I don't have the website. It's if you Google In Search of Tupac, you'll get the website. That's their website right there.
Okay, wow.
Did you read... Yeah, well, that's kind of cool.
No, it is. No, I think because, you know, talk about a role that will be scrutinized.
Yeah.
I mean, that will be, you know, that's a very important part to cast. So I think an unknown is the way to go with that. I really do. I don't see how you could, because this is like a major pop culture icon of the late 80s, early 90s, and I don't see how you get away. I don't see how it could become caricature if you put another named brand in there. I think it's
right.
Good to go with an unknown, really totally unknown. That's a good way to go.
Yeah. It's good that they're giving an unknown a shot. And playing Tupac, they should give him many shots.
God.
Did you hear, read
mm-hmm.
what the, sorry, that was so offensive.
That was. We're going to get going for that.
Did you read the, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's playing in the new Batman?
Yeah, there have been rumors about this a couple of weeks that he would play this character. I think it's interesting. I think it's good.
Okay, so tell me what character he's playing.
Isn't he playing the gangster's son, right? Falcone's son.
Right.
And I think that's good, because I think going with Robin would have been a disaster in this movie.
Ugh.
So I'm happy
Well,
that,
this is a villain, right?
Yeah. I think this is the way to go. But also another part of an actress, Juno Temple, had been cast in it as well. I read that somewhere.
Right.
Let's play some sort of Gotham City street punk or something. I don't know. I just read that. But no, the Levitt casting is that will work. I see that definitely coming together.
Yeah. Well, hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully. All I want to see is Anne Hathaway in a Catwoman outfit.
Yeah. That's what we all want to see.
That's all I'm here for.
Yeah, that's right. I want to see how he's going to balance. If anyone can do it, he can do it. But I'm just really curious to see how this comes together.
Yeah. So that's some interesting news. Anything else going on?
Well, that's all that. I would say that as far as casting news, you really picked on two of the big ones. I mean, I don't know of anything else that's really, that would be the big one.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we for the Kubrick series, we finally got Malcolm McDowell next week, so we'll be able to put together our episode 3 of the Kubrick series. So we'll be able to get that to you guys by the end of the month.
Awesome.
Spike Lee is 53 years old. Where's another great Spike Lee movie? How long has it been?
Well, what was the last one? Was a World War II movie?
Was that the last one? Miracle of Santa?
Yeah, it might be. And that had moments of greatness in it, but as a whole. But I'd have to. I hear it work. It's much better to watch it a second time. If you didn't like it the first time, I hear it. It actually is much better. I guess I liked Inside Man a lot, but I don't know. One of my favorite movies of his is really The 25th Hour, recent.
Yeah.
That would be definitely, I mean, even though that's not a popular movie, it didn't do well, I think that's an incredible film.
Absolutely. That's my favorite, too.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to him doing another narrative feature. I mean, I know he's been doing a lot of documentaries.
Yeah. I hope he makes something. There was talk for a while of an Inside Man, too, but I don't think that went anywhere.
Yeah. Russ Meyer. They're going to make a biopic of Russ Meyer.
Who's going to play Russ Meyer? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
Now, this is David O. Russell's doing this?
David O. Russell, yes.
I think he's kind of perfect for this. I think it just depends I want to know how they're going to do it, because this is a man who lived a very interesting life.
I still don't know what happened to the Hefner project that Robert Downey Jr. was supposed to do.
That's
with
right.
Brett Ratner.
Yeah, with Brett Ratner. There you go.
Yeah. I mean, if you talk about a perfect director for Hefner.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was probably it.
Yeah, there you go. Oh, my God. Okay.
Neil Jordan was writing. Actually, he was asked to write Spider-Man, the Broadway musical, early on. And he's the one that said no to it and had them bring on Julie Taymor instead. So Neil Jordan has come out and expressed his condolences for having done that. So that would have been a Neil Jordan Spider-Man. That's an odd combination.
Spider-Man musical just shouldn't happen at this point.
Well, there are all these kind of copycat musicals that they're putting up around Broadway, too, about Spider-Man. They're trying to capitalize on the long gestation process before the opening of the real thing. So they're kind of saying, you know, don't go see that $65 million. This is the real deal. This is down and dirty. We can do it better in a shorter amount of time without killing anyone.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah, so they've really... I don't know. It's that's going to be an interesting thing to watch unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. I don't get me wrong, I like Spider-Man and everything. I just don't see this thing for a musical with Spider-Man. I never understood what the big, you know, why this had to be.
Right.
But that's
you know one big scene in it. Yeah, I told you one big scene in it, where the female villain that Julie Taymor came up with.
Right.
There's a whole, like, opening act two number, I think it is, where they, it's a whole big musical number where she sings about shopping for shoes.
Oh my God.
I know. And you read that, and really? I mean, even a visionary like Taymor, but...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Really? Really?
That should be the name. Spider-Man, colon, really?
Yeah, I just don't see what... I think, if anything, it just, like, makes the reboot that they're, when they want to come out, is coming out in 3D. You're just like, I don't know whether this helps or hurts it, you know? I
mean, OSLCX in the chat room says, I don't really care about Spike Lee anymore. Well, that's ironic, because Spike Lee directed They Don't Really Care About Us for Michael Jackson, who's just been beaten by Justin Bieber. It all comes full circle, dude.
Are you just mentioning Justin Bieber, like, to put in the tags for people to look for the show?
Yeah. Okay. I'll sing some Justin Bieber for you. I don't care.
Oh, my God. Okay. Please don't.
So it's funny that Bieber's movie is having its way with Michael Jackson, because, you know, years ago it would have been the opposite. So
yes,
OSLCX also hears that they're making a Batman musical.
Wow.
Well, yeah, who knows? I don't know.
Why
don't they make
Hulk
Smash?
Let me ask you actually a serious question, going back to the interview. if that's okay, if I can do that.
We can get serious. That's
okay.
Fine. Yeah.
Okay. He said The Dark Knight, and yes, granted, The Dark Knight, we all think is an awesome movie and everything, but I am curious how this Batman trilogy of films, given the third one too, is going to hold up through the years. Because
right.
I'm sure this is obviously going to be the last one that Nolan and Bale have anything to do with. And it will, and I'm just curious to see how these films will age. Because, I like the first two Tim Burton movies, and they haven't aged that well in certain ways, but they're good. They did what they had to do. He wanted to take the character away from the Adam West spectacle, that show, and I think he did that very well. And then Joel Schumacher took it right back to that. And I'm just curious to see, like, how the Nolan films will age, and how some of the X-Men films will age, and the first two Spider-Man movies will age. This is a very interesting thing to think about. Like, 10 years from now, like, you know, we're scanning a planet with whatever we have, TV, computer, probably microchips or whatever. We're scanning around, The Dark Knight comes on. How will we think about it?
Yeah. Meanwhile, I rarely hear anyone talking about Batman Begins. I mean, it's all Dark Knight.
Yeah. I do like Batman Begins a lot, though. I think it's a very well-made film.
Spider-Man will always be popular with kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's impossible to answer. But
yeah, no, it's
an immaculately crafted movie, and it's, I think Dark Knight will survive because it's the same reason why a movie like Heat will survive.
Right.
Because it transcends its barriers, its genre.
Yeah. And I think
in a lot of ways.
I think that's why a lot of these films, like even some of The Godfather, you know, it's not just to call it a gangster film is insulting. It transcends the genre. It's really a movie. It is the ultimate movie about family, as far as I'm concerned. And that's why I think you're right. As I think that these films, that when they transcend the genre, that's why there was Silence of the Lambs is another example, I think.
Right.
It's not to call it a horror movie or whatever. No, it's much more than that. So, yeah. We'll see. I was just curious because this is a conversation about some of the films that you'd want to see. Like you said, you'd be very happy, and I would be too if Scott Pilgrim was on. Someone said, oh, that made me want to become a filmmaker.
Yeah, Silence of the Lambs. All right. Is that the great big fat person? She is a heavy girl, yes, sir. Yeah, that's a good movie. I'm still shocked at that one Best Picture. I'm still shocked that a movie as graphic as that one is the Best Picture winner.
Next, yeah.
Okay.
All right, team. Really? Really?
Yes.
Okay. No, I
Who was it? What was it up against again?
Oh God. What was it? That was 90. That would be the what was in 92, but it would be 91, the year of 1991. Bugsy. Was Prince of Tides nominated that year?
Right. Yeah, I think so. 91. Yeah.
But Barbara Streisand was
JFK.
JFK. Oh, okay. I see where we're getting at. Oh God, we don't want to talk. We're not going through the JFK
no.
thing again. Okay.
No, but I mean, Silence of the Lambs is very atypical.
Is bold. You're right. It is a bold choice. I was just thinking, because there are some people who would say the same about giving it to The Godfather and Godfather Part Two, which are considered very violent.
Right.
And you know, I'm sure that was at the time, and it still is. You know. But look at something, No Country for Old Men or The Departed, other violent movies. But they really, I think, it's what you guys said a couple months ago when there hasn't been a film like The King's Speech in the category for a couple of years, and it is the movie the Oscar loves. And when something like that is in the category, boom,
mm-hmm.
they ate it up. They went right for it, you know. So, but you're right about. No, I understand what you're saying about Silence of the Lambs, though.
Yeah. Okay, let's close off with our last interview for the night.
Okay.
Hang on, where am I at? I gotta find it first. All right, Jake Sandvig is just finished premiering his new movie, A Bag of Hammers, at South by Southwest. He co-writes and co-stars in the film with Jason Ritter and Rebecca Hall. I think it's about a couple of very immature con artists that bring on a little girl into their lives.
Right.
Hijinks ensue.
Uh-huh.
And here is Jake telling us about the experience of premiering his film at South by Southwest and the genesis of his film. Here he is.
I don't know.
You guys are stupid. I've got to be getting
I don't care what you say, Mel. I'm drawing dicks on his face.
Well, what is it that you do?
It is endlessly fucked up to me that you steal cars from dead people.
They're not dead people.
Yeah, they're dead people's relatives.
You want to ding-dong ditch a Mercedes that you stole from your ex-girlfriend on the day her father was buried?
Yeah, I do. That's what I want to do.
So what happens when your luck runs out, then what?
So, which one of you two is Amanda Deeper?
So tell me about the response to the film, first of all, from audiences there.
Well, you know, they've been great, and honestly, it's the best I've felt in so long. Just having the film, up on the screen and so big in front of so many fresh ears and eyes, and you know, hearing the laughs and the sniffles and the cries, and then you know, hearing the dead silence. It's you know, I mean, all of it. It's just. So satisfying.
I bet it is. Is it kind of nerve-wracking leading up to the premiere?
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, the red carpet thing is you know, not my favorite thing to do. So, you know, that's sort of what makes me the most nervous. But and not nervous, but just sort of, no, I guess it is nervous. But, you know, getting inside and sitting down, but this is definitely the most nervous and sort of, I mean, leading up to this, it was just because it was, you know, our baby and, you know, this is the premiere and all these people are seeing it and, you know, we're seeing it for the first time on this grand scale in this beautiful theater in Austin at this wonderful festival. It was, quite something.
So tell me about the festival and why it was important for you guys to premiere it there. What is it about that particular festival that fits your film, you think?
Well, South by Southwest, I've never been before. I've never been to Austin. Heard many great things about it. For me, it's just I love that the film was able to premiere here because it's everybody here that I've met and talked to are all so passionate, and it's so just free of pretense and, you know, people here are just, you know, they just love movies. And, you know, they're here to watch as many movies as they can and have their own opinions about these movies. And, you know, it's wonderful. And you know, like I said, everybody I've met and everybody we've worked with so far down here has been just a joy. So it's an honor to be here.
So tell me about a Bag of Hammers. First of all, if you can give my audience a little idea of what the film is about and the character you play.
A Bag of Hammers is it's a film about two best buddies, Alan and Ben, who are runaways from Fresno, who live in Los Angeles and steal cars from funerals while they pose as valets. And sort of are forced to grow up and start changing things when this little boy is sort of thrust into their lives.
And you co-wrote the film.
I did. I co-wrote it with Brian Crano, my good buddy, and also director of the film.
Tell me about that process. How does co-writing work exactly?
Brian had been talking about wanting to write a screenplay for a couple of months, and I basically just asked if I could help. And he said, "Yeah, sure." He was a little weird about it at first because you know, he had, I guess, heard some stories of, you know, co-writing things like ending friendships and creating this, you know, weirdness. But this one was great. We just had, you know, we both had, you know, a lot of ideas, and we sort of just merged them and sat down on my couch with his laptop and just started going. And I would talk as Alan and he would talk as Ben, and we sort of just riffed back and forth, and that's how it started.
Yeah. And the screenplay is extraordinary, and all the evidence you need of that are the actors that you're working with. I mean, you have Jason Ritter and Rebecca Hall. I mean, this is a great ensemble here. Tell me about the process of casting. I mean, did you have actors' faces in mind as you were writing these characters?
We did. We knew we wanted Rebecca and Amanda because they were friends of ours. And so as we were writing and sort of creating Amanda and Melanie, we said, well, this will be Rebecca's role. Rebecca and I are both tall and have brown eyes, so yeah, we can play brother and sister. And then Amanda will play Amanda. And that was that. But as far as the other roles go, the Ben and Kelsey and Lynette, you know, it's just standard casting procedure. And Chandler was the first kid we saw, and he absolutely blew us away. And we all knew right away that he was our kid. And then Jason and Carrie came in and did the same thing. And it was, you know, it was sort of a long process, but it was easy in the sense of, you know, when our three, you know, when Jason and Carrie and Chandler, when they, as soon as they came in, you know, we knew right away.
Mm-hmm. And when you get people involved in the film, actors and such, and you're actually shooting it, I mean, the script has lived in your mind for all this time. Does it become a different animal once the other collaborators come in?
I would say it does, you know, only because, you know, everybody, you know, bringing their own thing to the table and you sort of have it in your mind, but then, you know, it all sort of goes out the window and it's changed when, you know, it's another actor and not, you know, the Ben, Lynette, and Kelsey that you have in your head. And it's great, and it's refreshing too, because, you know, it's new and it's different, and you know, it's great to mix it up. So it's great. I love that part of it.
And going along that line, actually, when you see the finished film now, having worked on it for so long, does it exceed your expectations that you had from the beginning of this journey?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it does exceed my expectations, and also it's just, I mean, I always knew it was going to be a great film just because, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, it took us, you know, 6 years and we were busting our ass for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we knew the film that we wanted to make and we knew that we were going to love it, you know, and whether anybody else loved it or not, you know, we got to make the film that we wanted to make. And that's what was important. And, but yes, yeah, seeing it and, you know, and hearing people's reactions and reading people's reactions, it was absolutely exceeded my expectations.
Is there a distribution? Are you looking for distribution or is that already in place?
Yes, we are. We're trying to sell it here. And, you know, I can't say either way as of right now, but yeah, that is the goal, is to sell it here.
And you're going to continue to travel the festival circuit.
I do know we're going to Nashville with it in April, and then also Newport Beach in late April, I believe, is when that is.